Okay, welcome to the Savitri Reading Circle on Infinite Conversations. I'm here with GJ, John Robert, and Andrea. This is Marco Morelli. Matteo, who's often with us or usually with us, will be taking a break for a few months. And we are just about to begin our second reading of the first two cantos of Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother. And so we'll begin with a brief meditation.
So Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, Canto 1, the Pursuit of the Unknowable. All is too little that the world can give. Its power and knowledge are the gifts of time and cannot fill the spirit's sacred thirst. Although of one, these forms of greatness are, and by its breath of grace, our lives abide. Although more near to us than nearness self, it is some utter truth of what we are. Hidden by its own works, it seemed far off, impenetrable, occult, voiceless, obscure. The presence was lost by which all things have charm, the glory lacked of which they are dim signs. The world lived on, made empty of its cause, like love when the beloved's face is gone. The labor to know seemed a vain strife of mind. All knowledge ended in the unknowable. The effort to rule seemed a vain pride of will, a trivial achievement scorned by time. All power retired into the omnipotent. A cave of darkness guards the eternal light. A silence settled on his striving heart. Absolved from the voices of the world's desire, he turned to the ineffable's timeless call. A being intimate and unnameable, a wide, compelling ecstasy and peace felt in himself and all, and yet ungrasped, approached and faded from his soul's pursuit as if forever luring him beyond. Near it retreated, far it called him still. Nothing could satisfy but its delight. Its absence left the greatest actions dull. Its presence made the smallest seem divine.
When I was there, the heart's abyss was filled. But when the uplifting deity withdrew, existence lost its aim in the inane. The order of the immemorial planes, the godlike fullness of the instruments, were turned to props for an impermanent scene. But who that mightiness was, he knew not yet. Impalpable, yet filling all that is, it made and blotted out a million worlds, and took and lost a thousand shapes and names. It wore the guise of an indiscernible vast, or was a subtle kernel in the soul. A distant greatness left it huge and dim. A mystic closeness shut it sweetly in. It seemed sometimes a figment or a robe, and seemed sometimes his own colossal shade. A giant doubt overshadowed his advance. Across a neutral, all-supporting void whose blankness nursed his lone immortal spirit, allured towards some recondite supreme, aided, coerced by enigmatic powers, aspiring and half-sinking and upborn, invincibly he ascended without pause. Always a signless, vague immensity brooded without approach, beyond response, condemning finite things to nothingness, fronting him with the incommensurable. Then to the ascent there came a mighty term. A height was reached where nothing made could live, a line where every hope and search must cease, neared some tolerant, bare reality, a zero formed pregnant with boundless change. On a dizzy verge where all disguises fail and human mind must abdicate in light or die like a moth in the naked blaze of truth, he stood compelled to a tremendous choice.
All he had been, and all towards which he grew, must now be left behind, or else transform into a self of that which has no name. Alone and fronting an intangible force which offered nothing to the grasp of thought, his spirit faced the adventure of the inane. Abandoned by the worlds of form, he strove, a fruitful worldwide ignorance foundered there, here. Thought's long, far-circling journey touched its close and ineffective, paused the actor will. The symbol modes of being helped no more. The structures nations builds collapsing failed, and even the spirit that holds the universe fainted in luminous insufficiency. In an abysmal lapse of all things built, transcending every perishable support and joining at last its mighty origin, the separate self must melt or be reborn into a truth beyond the mind's appeal. All glory of outline, sweetness of harmony, rejected like a grace of trivial notes, expunged from being's silence, nude, austere, died into a fine and blissful nothingness. The demiurges lost their names and forms, the great schemed worlds that they had planned and wrought passed, taken and abolished one by one. The universe removed its colored veil, and at the unimaginable end of the huge riddle of created things appeared the far-seen Godhead of the whole, his feet firm based on life's stupendous wings, omnipotent, a lonely seer of time, inward, inscrutable, with diamond gaze. Attracted by the unfathomable regard, the unsolved slow cycles to their fount returned to rise again from that invisible sea.
All from his puissance born was now undone. Nothing remained in the cosmic mind. Nothing remained that the cosmic mind conceives. Eternity prepared to fade and seemed a hue and imposition on the void. Space was the fluttering of a dream that sank before its ending into nothing's deeps. The spirit that dies not and the Godhead's self seemed myths projected from the unknowable. From it all sprang. In it is called to cease. But what that was, no thought nor sight could tell. Only a formless form of self was left. A tenuous ghost of something that had been, the last experience of a lapsing wave before it sinks into a bornless sea. As if it kept even on the brink of naught, its bare feeling of the ocean whence it came. A vastness brooded free from sense of space. An everlastingness cut off from time, a strange, sublime, inalterable peace, silent, rejected from it world and soul. A stark, companionless reality answered at last to his soul's passionate search, passionless, wordless, absorbed in its fathomless hush. Keeping the mystery none would ever pierce, it brooded inscrutable and intangible, facing him with its dumb, tremendous calm. It had no kinship with the universe. There was no act, no movement in its vast. Life's question met by its silence died on her lips. The world's effort ceased convicted of ignorance, finding no sanction of supernal light. There was no mind there with its need to know. There was no heart there with its need to love. All person perished in its namelessness. There was no second. It had no partner or peer. Only itself was real to itself.
A pure existence, safe from thought and mood, a consciousness of unshared immortal bliss, it dwelt aloof in its bare infinite, one and unique, unutterably soul. A being formless, featureless, and mute, that knew itself by its own timeless self, aware forever in its emotionless depths, uncreating, uncreated, and unborn, the one by whom all live, who lives by none, an immeasurable luminous secrecy, guarded by the veils of the unmanifest, above the changing cosmic interlude, abode supreme, immutably the same, a silent cause, occult, impenetrable, infinite, eternal, unthinkable, alone. End of Canto One.
Shall we go on? Anybody have anything to say?
No, I could go on. Okay.
Canto Two, the Adoration of the Divine Mother. A stillness absolute, incommunicable, meets the sheer self-discovery of the soul. A wall of stillness shuts it from the world. A gulf of stillness swallows up the sense and makes unreal all that mind has known, all that the laboring senses still would weave, prolonging an imaged unreality. Self's vast spiritual silence occupies space. Only the inconceivable is left. Only the nameless, without space and time, abolishes the burdening need of life. Thought falls from us. We cease from joy and grief. The ego is dead. We are freed from being and care. We have done with birth and death and work and fate. O soul, it is too early to rejoice. Thou hast reached the boundless silence of the self. Thou hast leaped into a glad, divine abyss, but where hast thou thrown self's mission and self's power? On what dead bank on the eternal's road? One was within thee, who was self and world. What hast thou done for his purpose in the stars? Escape brings not the victory and the crown. Something thou camest to do from the unknown, but nothing is finished, and the world goes on because only half God's cosmic work is done. Only the everlasting no has neared and stared into thy eyes and killed thy heart. But where is the lover's everlasting yes, in immortality and the secret heart? The voice that chants to the creator fire, the symboled om, the great ascending word, the bridge between the rapture and the calm, the passion and the beauty of the bride, the chamber where the glorious enemies kiss, the smile that saves, the golden peak of things.
This too is truth at the mystic fount of life. A black veil has been lifted. We have seen the mighty shadow of the omniscient Lord. But who has lifted up the veil of light? And who has seen the body of the King? The mystery of God's birth and acts remains, leaving unbroken the last chapter seal, unsolved the riddle of the unfinished play. The cosmic player laughs within his mask, and still the last inviolate secret hides behind the human glory of a form, behind the gold eidolon of a name. A large white line has figured as a goal, but far beyond the ineffable sun tracks blaze. What seemed the source and end was a wide gate, a last bare step into eternity. An eye has opened upon timelessness. Infinity takes back the forms it gave, and through God's darkness or his naked light, his million rays return into the sun. There is a zero sign of the supreme. Nature, left nude and still, uncovers God. But in her grandiose nothingness, all is there. When her strong garbs are torn away from us, the soul's ignorance is slain, but not the soul. The zero covers an immortal face. A high and blank negation is not all. A huge extinction is not God's last word, life's ultimate sense, the close of being's course, the meaning of this great mysterious world. In absolute silence sleeps an absolute power.
Awaking, it can wake the trance-bound soul, and in the ray reveal the parent sun. It can make the world a vessel of spirit's force. It can fashion in the clay God's perfect shape. To free the self is but one radiant pace. Here to fulfill himself was God's desire. Even while he stood on being's naked edge, and all the passion and seeking of his soul faced their extinction in some featureless vast, the presence he yearned for suddenly drew close. Across the silence of the ultimate calm, out of a marvelous transcendence core, a body of wonder and translucency, as if a sweet mystic summary of herself escaping into the original bliss had come enlarged out of eternity, someone came infinite and absolute. A being of wisdom, power, and delight, even as a mother draws her child to her arms, took to her breast nature and world and soul. Abolishing the signless emptiness, breaking the vacancy and voiceless hush, piercing the limitless unknowable into the liberty of the motionless depths, a beautiful and felicitous luster stole. The power, the light, the bliss no word can speak, imaged itself in a surprising beam and built a golden passage to his heart, touching through him all longing sentient things. a moment's sweetness of the all-beautiful canceled the vanity of the cosmic whirl. A nature throbbing with a heart divine was felt in the unconscious universe. It made the breath a happy mystery.
A love that bore the cross of pain with joy, who demonized the sorrow of the world, made happy the weight of long unending time, the secret caught of God's felicity. Affirming in life a hidden ecstasy, it held the spirit to its miraculous course, carrying immortal values to the hours it justified the labor of the suns. For one was there, supreme beyond the God, a mother might broad brooded upon the world. Consciousness revealed its marvelous front, transcending all that is, denying none. Imperishable above our fallen heads, he felt a rapturous and unstumbling force. The undying truth appeared, the enduring power of all that here is made and then destroyed, the mother of all godheads and all strengths, who, mediatrix, binds earth to the supreme. The enigma seized that rules our nature's night, the covering nescience was unmasked and slain. Its mind of error was stripped off from things and the dull moods of its perverting will. Illumined by her all-seeing identity, knowledge and ignorance could strive no more. No longer could the Titan opposites, antagonist poles of the world's artifice, impose the illusion of their twofold screen, throwing their figures between us and her. The wisdom was near, disguised by its own works, of which the darkened universe is the robe. No more existence seemed an aimless fall. Extinction was no more the sole release. The hidden word was found, the long-sought clue. Revealed was the meaning of our spirit's birth. Condemned to an imperfect body and mind, in the inconscience of material things, and the indignity of mortal life.
A heart was felt in the spaces wide and bare, a burning love from white spiritual founts annulled the sorrow of the ignorant depths. Suffering was lost in her immortal smile. A life from beyond grew conqueror here of death. To err no more was natural to mind. Wrong could not come where all was light and love. The formless and the formed were joined in her. Immensity was exceeded by a look, a face revealed the crowded infinite. Incarnating inexpressibly in her limbs, the boundless joy the blind world forces seek, her body of beauty mooned the seas of bliss. At the head she stands of birth and toil and fate. In their slow round, the cycles turn to her call. Alone her hands can change time's dragon base. Hers is the mystery the night conceals. The spirit's alchemist energy is hers. She is the golden bridge, the wonderful fire. The luminous heart of the unknown is she, the power of silence in the depths of God. She is the force, the inevitable word, the magnet of our difficult ascent, the sun from which we kindle all our suns, the light that leans from the unrealized vasts, the joy that beckons from the impossible, the might of all that never yet came down. All nature dumbly calls to her alone, to heal with her feet the aching throb of life and break the seals on the dim soul of man and kindle her fire in the closed heart of things. All here shall be one day her sweetness's home. All contraries prepare her harmony. Towards her, our knowledge climbs, our passion gropes. To her miraculous rapture we shall dwell. In her miraculous rapture we shall dwell. Her clasp shall turn to ecstasy our pain. Our self shall be one self with all through her.
In her, confirmed because transformed in her, our life shall find in its fulfilled response above the boundless hushed beatitudes, below the wonder of the embrace divine. This known as in a thunder flash of God, the rapture of things eternal filled his limbs. Amazement fell upon his ravished sense. His spirit was caught in her intolerant flame. Once seen, his heart acknowledged only her. Only a hunger of infinite bliss was left. All aims in her were lost, then found in her. His base was gathered to one pointing spire. Thus was a seed cast into endless time. A word is spoken or a light is shown. A moment sees the ages toil to express. So flashing out of the timeless leaped the worlds. An eternal instant is the cause of the years. All he had done was to prepare a field. His small beginnings asked for a mighty end. For all that he had been must now new shape in him, her joy to embody, to enshrine her beauty and greatness in his house of life. But now his being was too wide for self. His heart's demand had grown immeasurable. His single freedom could not satisfy. Her light, her bliss, he asked for earth and men. But vain are human power and human love to break earth's seal of ignorance and death. His nature's might seemed now an infant's grasp. Heaven is too high for outstretched hands to seize. This light comes not by struggle or by thought. In the mind's silence, the transcendent acts, and the hushed heart hears the unuttered word. A vast surrender was his only strength.
A power that lives upon the heights must act. Bring into life's closed room the immortal's air and fill the finite with the infinite. All that denies must be torn out and slain and crushed, the many longings for whose sake we lose the one for whom our lives were made. Now other claims had hushed in him their cry. Only he longed to draw her presence and power into his heart and mind and breathing frame. Only he yearned to call forever down her healing touch of love and truth and joy into the darkness of the suffering world. His soul was freed and given to her alone. End of Canto 2.
One of the most powerful lines for me is a vast surrender was his only strength.
Are we ready to go on to the next canto, or feels like a good introduction to the next one?
Yeah. Pretty long one, right?
We might not get through it all today, but.
Yeah, let's go. So I forgot who starts reading.
Marco just had a little bit. He could start.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Marco, you want to do the first page?
Sure, I'd be glad to start. Although, to be honest, I'm still taking in the last canto. I just don't.
Well, let's slow down. We don't have to do this. We don't have to do this quick.
Yeah. Well, I was taking a look at these pages just before we began our session and recalling that where we had left off with book two was in a kind of a darker place. The journey of Ashwapati, you know, had kind of exhausted itself in a sort of solitary consciousness that somehow was like still unsatisfied. Like there was still this theme or this motif of disappointment and a kind of self-referentiality as well. And then we had this pivot to the Divine Mother. This new relationship is introduced into the narrative. And it's a very different orientation. I think it's worth noting that the orientation towards the feminine, towards the mother, is rather, I think, I guess, distinct or rather different for a Western reader, right? For somebody who's used to God the Father. There's no God the Mother in Christianity. Like there's Mary, Mother of God, who's human and is like beatified through her participation in the mystery of Jesus's birth, but really in the hierarchy of things is lower, I think. I mean, that's maybe theologically there's some argument about that. I don't know. But I think culturally and popular, at least the way I grew up in my mom's Catholic church, it was a patriarchy. And so I think this is something really new and different. And I'm noting there's these shifts in the poetics as well. There's almost like a new beauty that comes through in these pages. I think last time we had noted some of the language, like the Golden Bridge and bring that back, the Wonderful Fire. She is the Golden Bridge, the Wonderful Fire. And this vast surrender, that word vast, with the word surrender, is the part that I was kind of didn't quite know how to respond to you, Andrea, because I was wondering how vast. that's just why I wanted to pause for a moment. I think this is worth savoring.
I think right there at that point, he completely surrenders to her. It is that vast, it's everything. All of him is vast.
sort of following on the same lines of what Marco, you were saying, I noticed it when we went through it. So at the top of page 313, for one was there supreme behind the God. A mother might brooded upon the world. So this is not classical. Even many of the non-Christian religions don't have that idea, right? Of a feminine Godhead behind the masculine Godhead. So anyway, I noticed it when we went through there.
I wonder, would it be fair to equate or at least like associate or identify that kind of self, that absolute self who vast, unlimited, but alone? Would that be more, do you think, the masculine aspect of the infinite or divine behind which
you got muted somehow, Marco?
Did nothing I say just come through?
Just the last part of it was muted.
Oh, okay. Let me restate what I said. I think in a previous discussion that we had, I expressed a sense that there was a dance happening, that there was a kind of advance and retreat and something approaching and receding. And these waves of seeking and experiencing like expanded states or luminous realities or vastnesses beyond the small self, beyond the ego. And then we come to this point where there is an identification with a cause, an ultimate cause, but a cause that's mute, a cause that doesn't care, that is and is real, but also functions as an escape for the seeker. The seeker, can kind of abort themselves, abort mission, from this human struggle, and take a kind of refuge in this infinite blankness. But it's a beingness. It's not a falseness. It's a truth. But then there's a kind of wake up call that occurs, and a sort of calling back to the mission and purpose of being, and into a relationship with the mother. So I'm wondering if there is a polarity there, like the dance between the masculine and the feminine, that in finding the I am, in finding the causal alone, the causal infinite, still unknowable alone, that opens the consciousness to then the surrender to the feminine, to the mother. So I guess I'm wondering how, like, if we can read this dance as a dance of masculine and feminine faces of the divine, or dimensions of the divine.
I think it's more the human search for the ultimate truth, and then coming to the mother. I mean, of course, Ashwapati is male, and that kind of a search is very masculine, I would think. But,
So, Marco, I would say yes, that you can see it as a dance between the masculine and the feminine, or of the masculine and feminine. And that's not the only way to see it. But that, I mean, the Indian metaphors for life and for this ultimate seeking often uses this duality, the two in one. Well, we've come across the two in one before. At a certain point, maybe we get beyond gender, like in the transcendent. The transcendent is one. There's no other. That's what Ashwapati had reached. But it wasn't what he was after. It was what he was after, but it wasn't the final thing that he was after. He had to go there. But that was not the end of his goal. And when he reached the mother, that was, because his work was about this life, about this world, about the universe, and not about the escape that you were talking about, which Sri Aurobindo admits is a legitimate end for someone who's embodied and whose soul wants that. And that's one way. But he says that doesn't do anything for the world. And that was what his, Sri Aurobindo's project was: transformation of the world, not reaching the transcendent. But he said that was a necessary step. We had to contact that, because that's where the power comes from. And the power is the mother. The power to transform the world, the creative force. So, I mean, I don't know if there's any way to say ultimately in English or any human language, you know, what the meaning is, but on different levels, we can say, yeah, there's this play of the two, Sri Aurobindo and the mother, embodied it themselves.
When Sri Aurobindo met the mother for the first time, I'm not sure whether it was him saying it or her saying it, one of them said, I think mother, because he is, the work will be done. So there was this finding of the two, but because she got there as the Shakti, the work would get done.
That's also the collaboration. Would you call that the collaboration between?
Sure. Yeah, for sure. She said, without him, I do not exist. Without me, he is unmanifest.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure we haven't exhausted the subject.
Darn. I thought we finally got there.
Yeah, now it's just the beginning.
Just a note, I have to be off of this meeting a little bit ahead of 3, so 3 my time, so 1 Marco's time and 12.
Oh, so there's still actually an hour.
Yeah, there's still an hour. I'm just saying I need to get off a few minutes before the hour.
Yeah. Well, shall we move along? I think, Marco, were you going to read some more?
Sure. So this is Canto 3, The House of the Spirit and the New Creation. And it's a longer one. So what if we, since this is our first reading, pause and leave a space for any questions or comments in between the sections. So there's about 1, 2, 3, 4 three and a half pages until the first break. Okay. Book 3, The Book of the Divine Mother, Canto 3, The House of the Spirit and the New Creation. A mightier task remained than all he had done. To that he turned from which all being comes, a sign attending from the secrecy, which knows the truth ungrasped behind our thoughts, and guards the world with its all-seeing gaze. In the unapproachable stillness of his soul, intense, one-pointed, monumental, lone, patient he sat, like an incarnate hope, motionless on a pedestal of prayer. A strength he sought that was not yet on earth, help from a power too great for mortal will, the light of a truth now only seen afar, a sanction from his high omnipotent source. But from the appalling heights there stooped no voice. The timeless lids were closed. No opening came. A neutral, helpless void oppressed the years. In the texture of our bound humanity, he felt the stark resistance, huge and dumb, of our inconscient and unseeing base. The stubborn, mute rejection in life's depths, the ignorant no in the origin of things. A veiled collaboration with the night, even in himself, survived and hid from his view. Still, something in his earthly being kept its kinship with the inconscient whence it came. a shadowy unity with a vanished past, treasured in an old world frame, was lurking there, secret, unnoted by the illumined mind. And in subconscious whispers and in dream, still murmured at the mind's and spirit's choice.
Its treacherous elements spread like slippery grains, hoping the incoming truth might stumble and fall. And old ideal voices, wandering, moaned and pleaded for a heavenly leniency to the gracious imperfections of our earth and the sweet weaknesses of our mortal state. This now he willed to discover and exile, the element in him betraying God. All nature's recondite spaces were stripped bare, all her dim crypts and corners searched with fire, where refugee instincts and unshaped revolts could shelter, find in darkness sanctuary against the white purity of heaven's cleansing flame. All seemed to have perished that was undivine. Yet some minutest dissident might escape and still a center lurk of the blind force. For the inconscient too is infinite. The more its abysses we insist to sound, the more it stretches endlessly. Then, lest a human cry should spoil the truth, he tore desire up from its bleeding roots and offered to the gods the vacant place. Thus could he bear the touch immaculate. And a last and mightiest transformation came. His soul was all in front like a great sea, flooding the mind and body with its waves. His being spread to embrace the universe, united the within and the without, to make of life a cosmic harmony, an empire of the immanent divine. In this tremendous universality, not only his soul nature and mind sense included every soul and mind in his, but even the life of flesh and nerve was changed and grew one flesh and nerve with all that lives. He felt the joy of others as his joy. He bore the grief of others as his grief. His universal sympathy upbore, immense like ocean, the creation's load as earth upbears all being sacrificed, thrilled with the hidden transcendence, joy, and peace.
There was no more division's endless scroll. One grew the spirit's secret unity. All nature felt again the single bliss. There was no cleavage between soul and soul. There was no barrier between world and God. Overpowered were form and memory's limiting line. The covering mind was seized and torn apart. It was dissolved, and now no more could be. The one consciousness that made the world was seen. All now was luminosity and force, abolished in its last thin, fainting trace. The circle of the little self was gone. The separate being could no more be felt. It disappeared and knew itself no more, lost in the spirit's wide identity. His nature grew a movement of the all, exploring itself to find that all was he. his soul was a delegation of the all that turned from itself to join the one supreme. Transcended was the human formula. Man's heart that had obscured the inviolable assumed the mighty beating of a god's. His seeking mind ceased in the truth that knows. His life was a flow of the universal life. He stood fulfilled on the world's highest line, awaiting the ascent beyond the world, awaiting the descent, the world to save. A splendor and a symbol wrapped the earth. Serene epiphanies looked and hallowed vasts surrounded. Wise infinitudes were close and bright remotenesses leaned near and kin.
Sense failed in that tremendous lucency. Ephemeral voices from his hearing fell, and thought, potent no more, sank large and pale like a tired god into mysterious seas. The robes of mortal thinking were cast down, leaving his knowledge bare to absolute sight. Fate's driving ceased and nature's sleepless spur. The athlete heavings of the will were stilled in the omnipotent's unmoving peace. Life in his members lay down vast and mute, naked, unwalled, unterrified, it bore the immense regard of immortality. The last movement died and all at once grew still. A weight that was the unseen transcendence hand laid on his limbs the spirit's measureless seal. Infinity swallowed him into shoreless trance.
So what I got out of that is a geometry of the house of the spirit, which is the realm of the mother. I don't know if that makes any sense to anybody else.
What do you mean by geometry, JJ?
Well, because a lot of the references are spatial. So it is a kind of, let's see if I can find some examples. Anyway, I'll need to look to find them, but that was the sense I got.
There's a one-pointedness. There's a circle of the little self. There's the house.
Yeah, so all of those things.
Sorry, go ahead, Andrea.
Oh, yeah, I was really struck by the violence of he tore desire up from its bleeding roots. Ouch. Oh.
That phrase is, so that line is interesting because this is not the only place he uses that. He uses that in some of his other poetry. So I get that this is really something that stayed with him or happened to him that really stayed with him, that experience.
Mm-hmm. And that's a spatial reference too. You see, Tor from its reading roots and offers to the gods the vacant place. That's why mm-hmm. I think of it as a kind of geometry.
Mm-hmm.
I am a geometer, so it's hard for me not to see things that way, but.
I was struck by a similarity of this part of the canto that we read with something that's a quote from The Secret of the Veda. And I don't know the quote by heart, but it talks about I think the first part of it, I can't remember very well. It's like the revelation of the divine or something. And then there are dawns after dawns after dawns mm-hmm. where human beings dip back into the dark and they come back and they take in a little bit more of it and they dip back into the dark and they take mm-hmm. a little bit more of it. And so this first section summarizes some of the places that he's been before. And it's like he's doing this again. And each time he does it, he goes farther or he goes deeper. So he's helpless for a while. And then he has this, he finds, oh, there's more darkness in my being. And he tears that out. And then he comes back into the cosmic consciousness. So there's this kind of mini nirvana that happens, and then he finds this more veiling, and then he's able to take that out, and then he comes back to where even the life and the flesh of flesh and nerve was changed, all grew one flesh and nerve with all that lives. He felt the joy of others as his joy. So he comes back to the cosmic consciousness, and then Sri Aurobindo says that somewhere in here, he says the greatest change happens to him that's happened yet, and his soul comes all in front, and so it's like he's going through this short, in just a couple of pages, cycle that he's been going through, and he's being prepared for this vision of the house of the spirit and the new creation, which is the supramental.
My feeling starting this canto was there's a repetition again of, like, you know, he's found the mother, he's found this new source, you know, of inspiration and of power and purpose. And now he's got to get back to work. And I thought that first image of the sitting in prayer on a pedestal, yeah. Intense, one pointed. Like, I got this image in my mind of, like, a meditator and of intense focus and intense presence, intense beingness that, you know, one can access through that, the cultivation of that practice, and a kind of clarity that I think is here, because, you know, he comes in like a commando now, and what, there's still darkness in me, there's, you know, there's this collaboration, there's some kind of a conspiracy in his own being to perpetuate he calls it a betrayal, the element in him betraying God. And then all the spaces were stripped bare, dim crypts and corners searched with fire, where refugee instinct and unshaped revolts could shelter. And this is like a purge of, I wonder if he's like borrowing that sort of imagery or that language to make a point here, you know, or if it's, you know, really that intense.
Borrowing it from where?
Well, from like, I don't know, Stalin, or from the Mao or something.
Although the reference to the night always makes me think of the Queen of the Night in Mozart's Magic Flute, you know?
That's quite a bit more benevolent.
No, but she's the representation of evil in that story as well, so.
Good point, yeah. And then an empire, he's establishing an empire, you know, an empire of the immanent divine, tremendous universality. I think it's interesting that he also says that even the life of flesh and nerve was changed and grew one flesh and nerve with all that lives. Just before he says he felt the joy of others as his joy, he bore the grief of others as his joy. So it's like being rewired. It's hard to imagine the separate being felt no more, disappeared and knew itself no more, and to be lost in that spirit's wide identity, as he says.
In Sravana's last writings, he talked about something he called the mind of light. The mind of light, he said, for the human being to transform, to really change, and not just an individual, but for nature, you know, human nature, and for the whole manifestation to change, that this light had to come all the way down into the physical. And he said that this mind of light is this descent. He talked about, I think here, the ascent and the descent. And the descent has to come all the way down into the physical, and he called it the physical mind. When he left his body, Mother had an experience that she described as so palpable. She could feel the friction of it when he transferred to her body the light that he had in his own physical body. So he had so much light in his physical body that after he left his body stayed kind of in this glowing form for 4 days or something like that. And then when it finally started to give evidence of disintegration, that, I guess, I think it was earlier on than that. It was after he had left his body, but he transferred this force of light to the mother. And the mother then carried on his work or their work in the cells of the body. So it's rewiring, as you're calling it, Marco. And she spent another 20 years or something working on that.
I wonder, I mean, how was, did they ever study their cells? I mean, like under a microscope or like other means of, because for example, there are those experiments with water where if certain tones are played, I think cymatics is what it's called. You can look it up on YouTube, but how water will harmonize, like the shape, the geometry of a water molecule, water molecules will harmonize in response to tones or even intentions that are set. It would be interesting, I guess, from a scientific perspective, whether that could be observed like objectively. Or when we say that their bodies are full of light, what does that physically mean?
You know, there were many people who had extraordinary experiences being in Mother's presence. It's like, myself included, there was no desire to prove anything because it was, you experienced the reality of the almost translucency and the power. It was this amazing combination of total, utter sweetness with great power. And you couldn't help but feel it. It was just there. Nobody would think of putting it under a microscope. It's like, it's like, you get it, you know? Once you have the experience, like he's describing here, when he experience that, he gets the experiences and everything changes. And
I could get that for sure. Obviously, I'm not personally met Sri Aurobindo or the mother, but I've had similar encounters and not only with people, but with nature, with art, mm-hmm. or with poetry, yeah. There's some transmission, there's a force that comes through that's as real as the thing you would see under a microscope. Doesn't require the apparatus of the microscope to see. It's been, I think, in the last maybe 20 years, become a practice to try to bring together the spiritual and the scientific modes of inquiry. For example, the Dalai Lama does these conferences. Mm-hmm. I think it's called Science and Non-Duality, mm-hmm. Or it could be mixing them up. There's a few now that are kind of on that theme, where they like hook up monks to the, you know, brainwave machines and things like that. And they actually find that there are physical changes that correlate with the transformations in consciousness that are reported by real practitioners of a given path. So I'm curious if that's become a thing either the mother or followers in Oroville or in the wider community have done. But if not, that's okay too. I mean, this is also the Dalai Lama's, I guess, his attempt to bridge the cultures and to, create more of a dialogue between Buddhism and science and, those often kind of divided camps.
So Mother and Sri Aurobindo themselves were completely in embracing and including science. There was no separation. That's just what our human minds do, but there isn't any. It looks like there's no separation between the physical, the cellular vibration, and the divine. Us and that, there's no difference. I don't know, I'm just rambling here.
truly, there is none. Oh, but in human social practice, there tends to be I would see kind of like part of, let's say if we're attempting this transformation and this rebuilding or reorientation of the world, then even those practices, like the practice of science, would need to change from how it's done currently in order to embrace this evolutionary movement. But it would still be science. I mean, there's still a kind of mode that is knowledge oriented and inquiry oriented, and that, you know, attempts to establish an objective means of verification and, you know, reproducibility of experience and so forth. So I imagine that science could evolve in more spiritual directions, at the same time that spirit in its coming down and its descent into the human realm and into the realm of matter, which is already an expression of it, but in an unawakened sense, but in that descent of awakening, could this happening already, but could kind of infuse science with a new sensibility. So
I've been reading about articles, although there is a book that I will look into soon, by Carlo Rovelli. Remember, Carlo Rovelli was the one I wrote quite a lot about a couple of years back, about his ideas about time and quantum physics. He's a quantum physicist.
We did a couple of cafes on his work.
Yeah, yeah. But since then, he's done, he's kind of proposing a rethinking of quantum mechanics, in which essentially the main idea is that there aren't any objects at all. Their only relationships. And if quantum physics is rethought in this way, a lot of the paradoxes, the apparent paradoxes in quantum physics, tend to drop away. And so it's gaining a kind of an interest both in the physics community and outside the physics community because of these. But so in a way, it's another example of how when science is done sensitively, it tends to move in the same direction as the things that we're talking about in this regard. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been true for years, but that there have been those tendencies in the scientific world. I mean, we're moving away from the Cartesian mind-body separation, you know, which has been sort of built into science for the last 250 years. And we are in the process of slowly moving away from that. And that, of course, is also commensurate with the ideas that Sri Aurobindo was talking about. So there are a number of areas where this is happening.
I love that everything is relationship. This is absolutely gorgeous.
Yeah, so there are no objects at all, according to this idea. The whole idea of an object is, it's a kind of generalization that comes from relationships, but the root things going on are relationships, not objects. I'll find you. I think there was an article in The Guardian that I was reading, and I'll post a link to it. But he's also written a book about this.
So. I think the book that we were referencing back maybe a couple of years ago was called The Order of Time. Is that?
Yes, this is more recent work that he's been doing.
And I think it's worth saying, I mean, adding to that, that the like there's been a philosophical shift in European, American, you know, Western thought, you know, away from Cartesian dualism and toward, you know, more relational kind of theories of how you know, how the world is constituted, how the self is constituted. I think some of the 20th century and more contemporary philosophers also, I mean, in the wake of the, you know, the death of God that Nietzsche claimed, there was a kind of maybe searching for other ways of experiencing transcendence, and other ways of understanding transcendence. And various different, I think, philosophical movements attempting to do that, and some of them focusing more on the aspect of language, some focusing more on the aspect of like cognition, cognitive science, and, you know, where does consciousness intersect with religious experience, for example, has been, I think, a theme that's been explored scientifically and philosophically, you know, in different traditions, analytical and, you know, continental philosophy. So I think it's this vast surrender has many branches, you know, and facets to it. What I find most salient here is the individual's journey, like the individual's struggles and quest to transform themselves into a more more integral or more integrated or more clear, or I don't have the word for it, but a channel or a vessel of the divine. So I always appreciate our sessions here because they help me vibrate, I think, more, you know, they help my cells vibrate more in coherence with the infinite. So also to think through a lot of sometimes seemingly disparate topics, but they end up being related.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Andrea.
I just wanted to ask Jeffrey and Marco, have you received the recent collaboration?
So I received the link, but I haven't been able to access it because there's a problem with my password and stuff. So I have to untangle it.
You don't get the paper copy?
No, I just get the electronic.
Oh, it's really beautiful. And talk about Nietzsche. There's a wonderful reflections by Debashish Banerjee on Nietzsche and Sherbino. Really,
I got my paper copy actually just a couple days ago, and I've only had a chance to flip through it. I haven't really sat with it yet. But that piece in particular, Matteo had promoted it earlier because it was a piece I suppose that he had written some years ago. It was. Mm-hmm. It was published earlier. It was a gem from the archive.
Uh-huh.
And in it, he discusses Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche and Sri Aurobindo's like different visions of the supramental or the post-human Übermensch in German, mm-hmm. or
Overman.
Overman or Superman, depending on the translation. But Banerjee, he's a wonderful scholar, and he's, I think, he's one of my favorite because he has read some of, you know, more let's say modern, postmodern philosophers like Nietzsche and Deleuze, Gilles Deleuze, but also is steeped in Sri Aurobindo's work, and kind of bridge those divides. So I really enjoyed that article. And then I saw that there were a couple of conversations hosted about it too, with that Matteo organized with a few other members of the Sri Aurobindo community. Suma Gowda also participated. I didn't get to watch those yet, however. I only read the article and I liked it a lot.
I was just going to say, I'm following up on your comment about the sort of individual transformation. I appreciated what John Roberts said earlier about Sri Aurobindo's interest was the transformation of humanity rather than the individual process. So, obviously they're kind of complementary things, but I think that in a way, that is the difference between what's going on today compared to what was going on in the sort of 1960s, 70s, 80s, where there was a fascination with the individual transformation. But today, I think most people want to go beyond the individual transformation and look at how the individual transformation relates to the social and the larger context, which is commensurate with Sri Aurobindo's thought, I guess. So.
And that is the natural sequence of things, right? It's a natural development. It goes from the individual to beyond, to then include everything.
And it's a dialectic as well, because if the social context changes, I think it changes how what kinds of individuals we can be. I think we run into the limits of individual transformation when, you know, when we realize that it's hard to be an individual in a messed up society. And so attention turns then to improving the society or the relationship between the society and the world and so forth. But then I think that calls to the need for us to be individuals who are capable of that level of collaboration. And, you know, we find those shadow parts in ourselves and those parts that are broken and the parts that actually don't want what we claim that we want and actually, you know, just want something for ourselves, or, you know, it gets very complex. So I think the relational view is perhaps is more that there isn't an individual per se, that the site of individuality is you know, is a network of relationships and a community of relationships. And without those, there isn't a self really to speak of. There is the absolute void, but there isn't that you know, that embodied self that we are here to be. I'm noting that we're 20 minutes to the top of the hour, and I know GJ needed to leave early, so just wanted to note that.
Well, I guess we should maybe stop here. I don't know what you think, and just finish up with a meditation and stop there. It gives me a few minutes ahead of my other meeting. So
sounds good. Okay. Beautiful to be with you all again.
Likewise.
Find my bowls.
Thanks, everybody. I really enjoy reading with you, and I also enjoy the discussions and the things that people bring up in discussion. Very satisfying and enriching. Yeah.
And thank you all.
Can't be done alone, this kind of work. So
I so appreciate you all being willing to shift the week so that I could participate. Thank you for that.
And so we'll see each other next week, I guess, is the Savitri again.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
till next week, then.
Yes.
And you with Canto 3.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.